Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Heading into the big weekend. A lot of people, it'll be a big weekend for a lot of people who will take Monday off and make it a four-day weekend because 4th of July is Tuesday. Time for, what do people eat, Sarah, on the 4th of July? Hot dogs, you got it. Hamburgers, yes. Fireworks, they don't eat the fireworks, but all that's coming up. But we still have another great hour of Catholic Answers to do. Jimmy Akin is here, and we'll do an open forum with Jimmy. So go ahead and dial if you've got a question for Jimmy Akin. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Thank you for coming back again, Jimmy Akin.
Yeah, my pleasure, Cy Kellett.
Today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, this was a weird questions day, right?
Correct. Yes. So you actually appear in the episode.
I love those. Those are my favorite episodes when I appear.
Yeah. Cool.
Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, it was named, before the new Star Trek series, Strange New Worlds. Do you feel like they maybe stole from you at all? Or
I have my lawyers looking into that.
Okay. I hope it's a good team of lawyers. You've got on that. Put your best people on it. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-31-TRUTH. Do you watch the fireworks on 4th of July? Are you going to go out?
This 4th of July, probably not. I have other stuff happening next week.
Mm-hmm. I can see them from my house. Like they just shoot them off over my house. Actually, more and more people are doing their own fireworks here in California. This has become a new thing.
Good
and
for them.
Yeah, I think I'm in a hotbed of fireworks scoff laws in my neighborhood because it's wild on the 4th of July, and these are not patient scoff laws either. It will start probably tonight, and it will get some sort of fireworks show every night till the 4th of July.
Yeah, so. I have always thought the restrictions on fireworks are excessive. I grew up in the 1970s, as I know you did, and in Arkansas, fireworks are totally legal. And so we would get fireworks every year and set them off in our yard, and nobody ever got hurt, and we never started any forest fires, you know. I could understand some restrictions in some places, but having them basically be banned in California except for, you know, cities using them is to put on citywide celebrations. It seems excessive to me.
Yeah. Well, you would love my neighborhood then. You would love it. And they're better. Like, I do think, like, in the 70s, there was a lot of you would go. I think here you had to go over to Arizona to get your fireworks, but a lot of people did. Maybe it was Nevada. But they weren't the quality that they are today. These people, there's some high-quality fireworks out there.
So what was your favorite firework?
I just liked them loud. I loved the sound of, like, the louder the better, as far as I was concerned. How about you?
I liked several different ones. I liked Roman candles that would shoot off balls of colored flame.
Yeah.
Sparklers were a lot of fun because they were safe for kids, and they made all the sparkles, and you could wave them around. And I also liked ones called black cats, which were little black discs of charcoal, and you light them with a punt or something, and they would catch fire and start growing, and they looked like black worms.
Did they make any sound, or they were? Because I don't think
just a little hissing.
Oh yeah, because there were some that you could light, and they would spin around in the street. I don't remember what those were called. I did like those. Yeah. 888-318-7884. If you'd like to share your fireworks story reminiscence, you are welcome to. But also, you can ask Jimmy any question you want. We'll go to Boston, Massachusetts, where they have the big fireworks down by the Shell every year on the 4th of July. Been there a few times myself. Joseph, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, thanks, gentlemen. My question is about the number of Catholic media entities and personalities, including some clergy, who have varying degrees of qualifications but are making claims about the state of the church. Mm-hmm. So my question is, to what degree is the salvation of a soul dependent on correctly identifying apostasy, heresism, or schism within the church or the curia?
Okay, so if one correctly identifies apostasy, heresy, or schism, then you know what to avoid. And that makes your journey to heaven safer. So it's going to help individuals if they correctly identify heresy, apostasy, and schism. If someone falsely identifies heresy or apostasy or schism and acts on that, then we have a bit of a second question to ask, which is how responsible are they for the error that they made? If someone is innocently ignorant, if they're in what's sometimes called invulnerable ignorance, then God will not hold their mistake against them. And so if they, let's say, go into schism because they falsely understood what schism is, or if they leave the church because they falsely think that someone is a heretic or an apostate, then they would not have that mistake held against them, but they would be in a state of objective sin, you know, because they're no longer in the church, and that's objectively wrong, but they wouldn't be held accountable for it because they were innocently ignorant. But then there's a case where someone is not fully innocently ignorant, where they didn't display due diligence in coming to the conclusion that something was involved apostasy, heresy, or schism when it did not. And in that case, if they act on it and they, say, leave the church or go, you know, otherwise go into schism, then they will be held accountable for it. And that would have a negative impact on their salvation, potentially. So it is a very serious matter. It can involve either an objective grave sin that is not held against the person, or it can involve an objective grave sin that is held against the person. If you are falsely identifying things as heresy, apostasy, or schism that are not. Fortunately, the church has quite clear definitions on what each of these involve. And unfortunately, many people today, especially on the internet, are completely ignoring what the church's definitions of them are and are twisting them to mean something other than what they mean. For example, I see a lot of people saying, oh, the church or the Pope or this person is an apostate, when they are clearly not. Apostasy, according to the definition the church uses, is the total repudiation of the Christian faith. So as long as someone is willing to say, I'm a Christian, they are not an apostate. In order for someone to commit apostasy, they have to be willing to say, yeah, I'm not a Christian anymore at all. And so I see loads of people identifying much lesser offenses as if they were apostasy, and they're simply not. Also, I see a lot of people falsely overdiagnosing heresy. Heresy is something very specific. It is the post-baptismal refusal to accept a dogma of the faith, a dogma being a teaching that has been infallibly defined by the church to be divinely revealed. Not just to be true, it's not just a common opinion, it's something the church has used its power of infallibility to say specifically that it's divinely revealed. And I see lots of people flinging accusations of heresy that have nothing to do with that, where the church has never issued an infallible definition that the idea in question is divinely revealed. So I see numerous over-diagnoses of heresy by people who frankly should know better. I also see people under-diagnosing schism. Schism is the, and this is all Canon 751 of the Code of Canon Law, but schism is refusal of submission to the Roman Pontiff or the refusal of communion with those who are in communion with the Roman Pontiff. And I see some people saying, well, I don't think Francis is Pope, but I'm not a schismatic. Yes, you are. You are not giving submission to the Roman Pontiff if you are saying he's not Pope. And they may say something like, oh, well, you know, if he was Pope or if there were a Pope, I would give submission to him. Yeah, that's not the question. The question is, are you giving submission to the Roman pontiff? And if you say there ain't one right now, you are not giving submission to the Roman pontiff. And you're just using a dodge. So I understand you may not recognize that you're in schism, but the fact is you are. But then schismatics never claim to be schismatic, no matter who they are. I'm not a schismatic, and heretics never claim to be a heretic. You know, they claim I'm right in my views. The only people who may claim, who may own the title that applies to them, as apostates, who are like, well, yeah, I'm not a Christian anymore, so I'm an apostate, and I don't care. But I see lots of people, especially on the internet, underdiagnosing schism and overdiagnosing both heresy and apostasy, and I think they're leading a lot of people astray. And there is a danger here, because people who are not fully innocently ignorant will be held responsible for any negligence that they displayed in coming to these conclusions and acting on them. And that will endanger souls, and so, as well as harming the church and harming the mission of Christ. So I think there are a lot of people out there, especially on the internet, who are acting gravely irresponsibly by making charges like this when they are simply mistaken. Joseph, if you'd like more information about this, you're here in the United States, so we can send you a copy of my book, Teaching with Authority, where I go into all this in great detail.
Hang on, Joseph. If you'd like the book, we'll get your address and send it to you. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, why don't you air these people? And I said, no, because I don't think they're Catholic. He says, by what right do you have to say that? I said, I own the network.
Mother Angelica Live Classics, every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, heading into the big holiday weekend here in the United States. And before we do, we got to say goodbye to somebody. You hear me talking to Sarah sometimes. Sarah gives us the groovy music when she remembers on Thursdays and does a great job. As a matter of fact, Sarah's been running all the equipment in the studio here. And I don't think we've ever recorded her making a mistake. I don't recall ever her making a mistake. And she does a bunch of other things for the apostolate. And I just wanted to say, because you're moving to a different country. You're moving to the Republic of Texas, yeah. Correct?
Yes, correct.
So thanks for everything you've done, Sarah.
Thank you, Cy.
How long have you been here?
Combined, about 3 years.
But you started as an intern here.
I did, yes.
Yeah, because I remember one day there were all interns in the studio when I came out after the first hour. And I said, who's in charge if it's all interns? And every single other intern turned and said, her. And they all pointed at you.
I think I just happened to be the oldest one.
I don't think that was it. You have the air of competence about you.
Oh,
you're a very
competent
person. So what brought you here to Catholic Answers?
Well, I work here with my dad. I had gone away to school for a little bit, decided not to go back. He said he had some work for me to do, so I said, that sounds great. I'll make a little bit of money. And
so what does your dad do here?
He's the director of development.
That guy is your dad?
Yes.
David, the director of development, who also fill-in hosts on this show sometimes?
Yes.
Have you run the board when your dad's doing the hosting?
I have, yes.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a whole family affair in here.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you like it here at Catholic Answers?
Oh, absolutely.
You did?
Yes.
Would you tell me if you didn't? Or
I would, yeah. No, I don't think I would.
So, Thank you for the honesty. You probably wouldn't. No. Well, I teased you about a month ago that before you left, I was going to make you host the show, and you just didn't seem very happy about that.
I probably went white.
Did you go? Yeah, you probably did go white. So I'm not going to make you do that.
Okay,
but I did want you to come in here because people hear about you all the time, and I just wanted to let people know that you were going. That's why they won't be hearing Sarah's name in here. Well, we might be. They might hear your name, but it'll be mostly because I'll be saying to other people, "Why can't you do it like Sarah did it?" That's going to come up.
Oh, thank you.
I'll tell you what. Would you do me a favor before you go?
Sure.
Would you host the show for a minute and just say who the next caller is?
Absolutely. Yes.
And then say to them, "Thanks for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin," and then I'll put them on.
Okay.
What line are they on?
Line one.
Yep. Okay. So when you're done, I'll do line one.
Okay.
All right. So you're hosting now. Go.
Okay. Our next caller is Steven, calling from Matthews, Virginia. Steven, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
I knew you were going to be competent at every single job here. All right. Sorry, Steven. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to get some speculation from Jimmy about alien life, intelligent, fallen, rational alien life. It's often said that the size of the universe could indicate that there must be life elsewhere. Also, I've heard Jimmy say that Jesus could have incarnated, or God the Son could have had other incarnations in other galaxies, other planets. But my question is, like, regardless of that, we still have Mary is the Earth's incarnation's mother, is exalted as the queen of like all the angels, queen of heaven, queen of the universe. So it seems that Earth has a very special relationship either way with God, and it seems that it could also mean that it could be the only place with rational life or fallen life. But then also, just in general, what would that mean for the other incarnations' mothers? Like, why would they not be as exalted as the one from Earth? That's pretty much it. Just wanted to see Jimmy's thoughts on that.
Okay, so you specified that this is fallen intelligent alien life, and you know it wouldn't impact the Catholic faith or the Christian faith itself, because the faith has no teaching on this. So it wouldn't falsify anything about the faith if it turned out that there are fallen intelligent creatures elsewhere. And what would happen with them? Well, we don't know. First thing I'm going to do is recommend an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World to you, where I go through all these implications in a lot of detail. It's episode 55, so you can get to it by going to mysterious.fm/55. And it'll give you much more detail than I can go into at the moment. But it could, in summary form, it could be that this fallen race is so fallen that they don't get redeemed. It could also be that God redeemed them in some way. And according to St. Thomas Aquinas, God has liberty to redeem people in any way he chooses, including just by saying, okay, you're all redeemed now. He chose to use the incarnation and death of his son in our case. He may have chosen something similar in their cases. He could send God the Son to other planets and have incarnations there. That's also something, not other planets, but other incarnations is something that St. Thomas Aquinas talks about. And he says basically God's omnipotent. So God can do what he chooses in regard to incarnations. It would be possible for God the Son to incarnate in other bodies. It would be possible for the Father and the Holy Spirit to incarnate in other bodies. There are other variations he goes into, but he would say it's quite possible. That's a standard opinion of St. Thomas. Then there's the question of Mary's status. And it's true that we apply the term Queen of Heaven to Mary. The thing is, though, we tend to associate queenship with there being one queen. And that's because in Christian society, we practice monogamy. So a man has only one queen. If a man has only one wife, and if the man is a king, he's only got one queen. But in Israelite society, there could be multiple queens at the same time. And so I can't rule out hypothetically, since I don't know what God would do with alien races. I don't know that alien races even exist. But if they exist, God could choose to have co-queenship among different mothers of different incarnations of the Son. At least that's a hypothetical possibility, meaning it does not contain a logical contradiction. The terms involved do not contradict each other, and so it's within the power of God's omnipotence to bring it about. And I have to leave it to him to decide what he actually has brought about, and I don't have the data to assert any opinion over any other opinion. I can just sketch out what some of the options are.
Okay, thank you for your call, Stephen. I hope that helped.
Nice job, Sarah. See ya. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Sarah.
I know this wasn't the most comfortable moment of your life, but I'm so glad you came in. And we got to say goodbye to you.
Yes, thank you so much. And I just want to say thank you to you for always making my time here in the studio enjoyable. I've always really enjoyed being in here and working with everyone here, but you, Sai, you're wonderful. Thank you.
Wow. All right, we should just go to a commercial while I tear up, probably. Well, I don't have time to go to a commercial. Let's go to Katie in San Francisco. That's so nice, Sarah. Thank you. It's been wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
San Francisco, California. Katie, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, hello. Thank you, sir. And thank you, Sarah.
She said, thank you, Sarah.
This is kind of a weird... well, this is kind of a weird question, but so walking down the street the other day, we see a priest in uniform, and my dad says, oh, he's Eastern Orthodox. I say, how do you know? He says, it's the beard. And so I'm wondering, and then I noticed most of the Roman Catholic priests, they have shaven beards, but a lot of those in the Byzantine or the Eastern Catholic Church or even the Eastern Orthodox Church, they have these big, long beards. Is there some sort of rule about that, or how did that happen?
So,
why did that happen?
So hair grooming customs vary over time and in different locations, and there are various reasons for that, some of which have been studied by sociologists. One of the things they find is they tend to go in cycles. So for a while, having a short beard will be fashionable, then having a longer beard will be fashionable, then it'll go back to short beards are fashionable, then it'll go back to clean shaven is fashionable, and it tends to oscillate between different lengths of facial hair. Mustaches also can go through cycles like that, and women's hemlines do. They've observed the same thing happening. Sometimes hemlines are very short, then they start getting longer and longer and longer and longer, but they can't get too long because the woman will start tripping over them if they get too long, and so then they go move in the other direction and start getting shorter and shorter again. And you can follow these social trends through surveys and other means and document that they just change over time. And that's true of facial hair in different groups. Now, there is no rule that prohibits Latin rite priests from having beards. In fact, I know many of them that do. You know, Father Pacwa on EWTN has a beard. Padre Pio, who's a saint now, he had a beard, and he was a Capuchin. He was here in the West. So there are bearded Catholic priests. It tends in the West to just be a matter of personal choice what your facial hair length is going to be. In terms of Eastern priests, whether they're Eastern Catholics or Eastern Orthodox, I've observed the same thing, that they tend to have beards, often longer ones. What I don't know is, in their case, is there any rule? And it might be that in an individual group of priests, like let's say at a monastery, there might be a rule. You know, we're all at this monastery as part of our habit, we're going to wear beards of X length. That could be the case, but I don't have any documentation to show that's the case. So it's also, as far as I know, it's also possible that it's just a matter of culture of the local monastery or the local order or the local, you know, church to have priests with beards of a given length. or not, because people also tend to fit in with those who are around them. And so if you join a monastery and all the guys got long beards, you may grow a long beard too, just to fit in. And so it can be not something that's a matter of rules, but just a matter of human psychology.
Katie?
Thank you so much. Nice beard, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You know, that's funny, Katie. I thought that was going to be your question. I thought you might be going to ask Jimmy if he was Orthodox, but no. You went a different direction. Thank you, Katie. I look forward to talking with you again sometime. The number here is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and that means not only are we open to anyone, whether you are a believer or not, whether you're a Christian, a Catholic, or anything else, your question is welcome, but it also means we're really open to anything, because Jimmy's happy to take your question, whatever it is. 888-318-7884. Are you ready to defend your faith in a world of unbelief? Join us at the 9th Annual Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference. This year's theme, I Believe in God, and it'll help you provide clear and charitable answers to atheism, agnosticism, and plain old indifference. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us in San Diego from September 21st through 24th as we welcome our special guest, Dr. Scott Hahn, and an all-star lineup of great Catholic speakers. Spend quality time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and enjoy 4 days of fun, fellowship, and adoration of the Almighty. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register. Enter promo code EARLY and save $50. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. This Independence Day weekend, there's a big sale over at shop.catholic.com. 25% off any purchase of $25 or more. 25% off any purchase of $25 or more when you use promo code USA25 at checkout. Check it all out at shop.catholic.com. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, a little bit of bonus open forum for you on a Friday afternoon. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, you're welcome to call. If you have a question about anything else, you're welcome to call. 888-318-7884. We go now up to Ontario, Canada, where Ava is on the line. Ava, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Ava, I'm very sensitive to tone of voice, and you sound older. Did you get older recently?
I did. I turned 16 a couple of days ago.
Well, happy birthday again, Ava. Thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Akin.
Thank you. And thanks a lot for wishing me a happy birthday with the flannel panel.
You're very welcome. Your dad put us up to that.
Yes, thank you.
All right, Ava, go ahead.
My question is, do people have personalities, do people have the same personalities they did on earth when they get to heaven, since personalities are combinations of people's likes and dislikes and flaws in their opinions? So if when they're in heaven, they're perfect and they have a perfect personality, does that mean everyone has a very similar personality since they're all perfect? Or would they have a personality that is like their old personality on Earth?
At least the way the church conceptualizes this, you know, there are, for example, patron saints of different things, like, you know, Saint Ambrose is patron saint of Milan because he used to live in Milan, and Saint Patrick is the patron saint of Ireland because he evangelized Ireland, and there are bunches of others as well. And to the extent that this patron saint phenomenon accurately reflects what a saint's interests are, we would presumably be able to infer that, you know, Saint Patrick has a special interest in Ireland. You know, he cares for the Irish people in a special way because he evangelized them. And Saint Ambrose cares for the people of Milan in a special way because he used to be their bishop. Now, obviously, being perfect, they love everybody. But that's not inconsistent with them having a special concern and a special interest in praying for the people who are under their patronage. And so if that's true, now the church does not have a teaching on this, so what I'm engaging in right now is theological speculation. But I would assume that patron saints either natively have or acquire a special interest in those who turn to them for their patronage, and thus that would reflect a personality difference. Saint Patrick would have a special interest in praying for people from Ireland, and Saint Ambrose wouldn't have that. Now, they both pray for everybody. Saint Patrick would pray for Milanese people, and Saint Ambrose would pray for Irish people, but it would seem that they have a special interest in those who turn to them regularly for their prayers. We also have no evidence that our personalities are going to be wiped. We're told that we're going to be like Jesus, but that doesn't mean that it's going to override all of our preferences and everything like that, because there are multiple things that are compatible with holiness. You know, you can be perfectly loving, which is what holy is, and you might still prefer chocolate ice cream over vanilla or strawberry. Or you might prefer strawberry ice cream over chocolate or vanilla. So we don't have evidence that our personalities are and all of our preferences and things like that are going to be the same. What we do know is we'll be perfected in love, and so we'll be perfectly loving people. But that doesn't mean we won't have personal preferences based on our memories and our experiences and our choices. So I would say that even though the church doesn't have a teaching on this, I would not view it as likely that there will be no differences in people's personalities. I would expect personality differences to continue.
Okay, Eva?
Okay, thank you. Because I've heard of different saints, like Saint Teresa, having a sense of humor. And so I was wondering if that would be, like, possible.
Yeah, I'd say that's possible. Some people have more of a sense of humor than others, and as long as the person is perfectly loving in heaven, they may express that love in humor more than someone else does.
Ava, thank you very, very much. I almost wished Ava a happy 4th of July weekend, but they don't do that up there in Ontario. Sorry, Ava. I know you're a Commonwealth country. Dave in Billings, Montana, you are next. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, good afternoon, Jimmy. How you doing?
Doing okay. What's your question?
My question is about Islam. We have a friend of ours who was married to a Muslim who followed her child. I love her child, but he disappeared. This is back in Minnesota. She lives here in Billings, Montana now. So I got a copy of the Quran. I've had it for quite a while. It's not
Dave, I'm not really sure what your question is. Could you put it in the form of a question, please?
My question, Allah is their God. Is Allah a devil or an angel?
Neither. Allah is simply the Arabic word for God, and it's used by Arabic-speaking Christians for God. What Muslims believe Allah is the creator of the universe, and they believe that he appeared to Abraham, and that he's God, and the only God. And about all that, they're right. There is only one God. He created the universe and he appeared to Abraham. So that doesn't mean Muslims have a complete understanding of God. They have some incomplete knowledge of him. They also have some mistakes in their understanding of God. But okay, nobody has complete knowledge of God because his mystery is infinite and our brains are finite. The Jewish people also, they didn't know God was a Trinity before the time of Christ, but they were still worshiping God. Jesus tells the disciples, you believe in God, believe also in me. And so, you know, Jewish people could worship God without knowing he's a Trinity. And people can have mistakes in their understanding of God. In fact, almost everybody does, because we all have experiences that color our perception of God in ways that may not be accurate. You know, if someone grew up in an abusive family with an abusive father figure, you know, let's say emotionally abusive, or it could be physically abusive, then they're likely to project the image of their father on God and misunderstand God's love and his mercy. But that doesn't mean they're not capable of talking to God or praying to God, or that the person they're worshiping in heaven isn't really God. So Muslims have incomplete and inaccurate knowledge about God, but they have a fundamentally correct understanding of God, which is that there is only one God, he created the universe, and he appeared to Abraham. They're right about all that. And so when they address their prayers to the creator of the universe who appeared to Abraham, God knows that they are talking to him. And in Arabic, they use the word Allah to refer to God. That's true whether it's an Arabic-speaking Christian or an Arabic-speaking Muslim. Also, you know, in Aramaic, the Aramaic word for God was Allah. It was the same basic word, it's just pronounced a little differently. So when Jesus and the apostles talked about God, they would have been talking about Allah. And so God, Allah, or, you know, God, is not an angel or a devil. He's a deity, and he's the only deity. And this is not a new modern view. This is, St. Thomas Aquinas would say the same thing. This is the standard view in Christian history.
Dave, thank you. I'm going to leave that there and keep moving, try to get as many on as I can as we near the end here with Jimmy this afternoon. I'm going to go to Donald in New Jersey. Donald, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Si. Hi, Jimmy. I was wondering, the Pope showed a lot of favor towards women, but he says he doesn't want ordination of women. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what if someday women could be priests? And I said, no, I've had it. I'm going to quit the church. Would I be an apostate then? Because I can see even a more of a loss of attendance if women become priests.
Okay, so we had covered the definition of apostasy, heresy, and schism earlier in the show. Apostasy is the total repudiation of the Christian faith. So if you said, I'm leaving Christianity, I am no longer a Christian, then yes, you would be an apostate. But if you just said, I'm done being an active Catholic, I'm just going to stay at home on Sundays, well, you would still be a Catholic. You'd be a backslidden Catholic, but you'd still be a Catholic. If you said, I'm going to leave the Catholic Church, but otherwise remain a Christian, you would be a schismatic. I think you should not worry about this scenario, because John Paul II taught that the church is already infallibly defined, that women cannot be ordained to the priesthood. It is a not infallibly settled question as to whether they could be ordained to the diaconate, but it's already been infallibly defined that they can't be ordained to the priesthood. So that's not going to happen, and you're causing yourself unnecessary stress and possibly alienating yourself from the church and harming your spiritual life if you worry about something that's never going to happen. Even if, you know, there was a someone in the future who tried to ordain women, well, that's already happened. There have already been rogue bishops who've tried to ordain women, and none of those ordinations are valid. And so even if rogue, even if invalid ordination of women to the priesthood occurred on a larger scale in the future, that would be no reason to leave the church. And so one could remain a Catholic and just say, well, this bad thing's going on, but I don't approve of it, and I'm not going to let it destroy my spiritual life, which is always the correct response. Do not let what other people do destroy your spiritual life, or such as by causing you to quit the church. Quitting the church is always a mistake, no matter what others have done or are doing. So the thing to do, even if there were invalid ordinations of women to the priesthood in the future, would be to stay where you are and continue to live as a Catholic and pray for the people who were involved in the invalid ordinations. But worrying about it now, when it's not even happening, is something that's only going to be destructive of your spiritual life and corrosive of your peace in the church. And you're hurting yourself by worrying about things unnecessarily. So don't hurt yourself. Put it out of your mind and don't worry about it.
Donald, I will leave it there. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I told him about the woman who came to me and said her two children hadn't spoken to each other for 2 years. Their grandma died and she was very wealthy. She left half to each one. She said they're arguing over a commode. She said it's inlaid. Can you imagine being in hell and somebody saying to you, what are you here for?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour, and it's open forum and a whole bunch of folks on the line for Jimmy. So back we go to the phones to Caitlin in Cleveland, Ohio. Caitlin, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So I know I've heard Jimmy talk in the past about like ghosts and the supernatural and stuff. And if I recall correctly, he said that if you were to like encounter a ghost or one were to appear to you, you have to test it to see if it's like truly the person who's like is claiming to be. So I guess my question is like, how would you go about doing that?
Well, so the testing takes place in a couple of different ways. It really depends on the situation. So the New Testament contains, and this is reflected both in the writings of St. Paul and St. John, but it's specifically St. John who says, do not believe every spirit, not every spirit is of God, but test the spirits. And you can look that up. That's 1 John 4, the beginning of 1 John 4. So the context in which St. John is talking, and also the one in which St. Paul is talking, is about getting information from spirits that would pertain to religious topics. Like if, you know, you're in a first century church and there's a prophet who is in contact with spirits and the spirits are giving the prophet prophecies, well, that's when you need to test them for those purposes. If you're in a different situation, if someone is just reporting experiencing a ghost in their house and they think maybe it's the person who used to live in the house or something like that, then they wouldn't really probably be giving you information of a religious nature. And so you might test them in this circumstance to see, do we have evidence that an actual ghost is involved in this situation. And there are various techniques that paranormal investigators use to try to determine if a reported apparition, and that's the term that gets used in parapsychology for appearances of ghosts. It's the same term that the church uses for appearances of souls of the saints and of those in purgatory. So if you have a report of an apparition occurring in a house, there are tests you can do to try to eliminate natural causes. If you find that, let's say the people in the house are hearing footsteps, human footsteps, and they hear them every night at 10:30 p.m. Well, okay, one of the things you want to do is consider, could there be a natural explanation for the footsteps they're hearing? And sometimes there is. I know of a case where at the same time, I know the investigator who covered this case, where every night at a certain time, the family in this house was hearing what sounded like human footsteps. And it sounded like they were coming from the attic. So he staked out the attic and he stayed up there. He got up there before the appointed time for the footsteps and he waited. And then at the appointed time, here comes a squirrel that's gathering nuts in the attic. And as the sound of the squirrel is distorted through the floorboards of the attic, it sounds like human footsteps to the people in the house below. And they're shouting up going, hey, are you okay? We're hearing the footsteps. And it was just a squirrel. So what competent parapsychological investigators do is they make a list of everything that could explain the different phenomena that are being reported. And then they go through and investigate, does a natural thing explain these different phenomena? And sometimes they do, like in the squirrel footsteps case that I just mentioned. If it turns out that there is no good natural explanation for all of the phenomena, then it becomes reasonable to propose that we are dealing with something paranormal here. We're dealing with a real ghost. And one can try to speak to the ghost. One can make contact with it. One can ask it questions. One can test the ghost's knowledge. You know, if the ghost is saying, if you need to, you can say, okay, so tell me about the history of this house. And if the ghost is able to accurately describe the history of the house and you can verify what it says, well, that gives you at least some reason to think that the ghost may be the former inhabitant of the house. That doesn't prove it, because people can impersonate other people even in this life. But, you know, Psyche Hellett could be a total imposter. You know, he could be a pod person for all I know. I can't prove that that's not the case. But as long as I don't have evidence that he is an imposter, I assume that Psyche Hellett is who he appears to be. And so in the case of a ghost, if they appear to be who they are, you know, like if they're, say they're the former inhabitant of the house and they know the history of the house, until you get contrary evidence, you should assume that's who they are. But if you get contrary evidence, like if they start telling you things like, hey, you know what, you really need to go worship the god Baal. Well, okay, now you've got a problem, because the ghost is saying something that is flatly contradicted by the Christian faith, and they may be an imposter. They may, in fact, be a demon, but you need evidence to propose that it's a demon. You don't just assume things are demons. The authors of the New Testament did not tell us to assume that things are demons. They said to test the spirits and see if they're of God. They didn't say assume every spirit is a demon. So they expect us to use testing when it's reasonable. And certainly if a ghost starts making religious claims, that's when the major form of testing needs to be done. Of, is this what this ghost is claiming consistent with the Christian faith, or is this a deceiving spirit?
Caitlin, thank you. I'm going to leave that there. I hope that was helpful to you. I am not a pod person, just so that you know.
Well, that's exactly what a pod person would say.
Oh, I knew there was going to be a twist. Okay, thank you, Caitlin. Joe's in Northern Kentucky. We're glad you're here, Joe. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Like the show, Jimmy, like Mysterious World. Quick question for you. If a grandparent, for example, and this has not happened, decides that they are worried about a child, a grandchild, you know, being baptized, and they secretly baptize that child out of, you know, concern that something could happen, and then the parents and kind of come around and they get back to the faith and they decide to take the child and have them baptized, has the parent's baptism caused a conflict with the like a church baptism?
Okay, so number one, the right of the natural law right of parents to make decisions about their children's baptism must be respected. So grandparents cannot secretly baptize their children. It is against church law to do that. So this should not happen. The only exception is if the child is in danger of death. Not just, oh, the child maybe could die someday. If the child is in imminent danger of death, then they can be baptized even against the parent's will. But as long as the child is not in imminent danger of death, they must not be baptized. Having said that, if a grandparent broke the law and baptized the child again, anyway, in secret, then when the parents go to have the child baptized in church, the grandparent needs to speak up and say, and fess up and say, I already baptized this child in secret. And that's going to throw a big wrench in the church baptism, and the parents are probably going to be mad at the grandparent, and justly so, because the grandparent not only baptized the child against their wishes, but the grandparent also is now caused a big problem where we're not going to be able to baptize this baby in church because it's already been baptized secretly. So this is, apart from danger of death, this is a bad idea, and I would recommend it not happen.
And again, I'm going to leave that there and see if we can get everybody on with Jimmy. Thank you very much, Joe. Tim's in Idaho. Tim, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hey, Jimmy. My question is, if a priest is an exorcist and does an exorcism on a victim, if you will, I don't know what to call him, but that is not accept. Hello?
No. Yep,
go ahead. You're on the air, Tim. Go on with your question.
Oh, yeah. So if the priest is exorcising someone who doesn't want to be exorcised, is that an effective, I don't know, I don't think it's a sacrament, but is it effective?
It may or may not be. The consent, now, we have to distinguish between what is how exorcisms are normally done today, and normally you do have the, if you're having a private exorcism done, you normally have the person's consent, but it's not required that that happen for an exorcism to take place. There are involuntary exorcisms that take place, and we even see them in the New Testament. For example, in Acts chapter 16, St. Paul encounters a young woman who has a spirit of Python that is enabling her to predict the future. And she keeps calling out after Paul and his party that these men will show you a way of eternal salvation, which actually is good advertising for the gospel, but it's annoying St. Paul. Now, the text doesn't say that this spirit of Python is a demon, but it does say that, and it would be a little strange for a demon to be saying, hey, go to these guys to get eternal salvation. You know, that would be a little strange for a demon to do. So this may be some weird kind of spirit that doesn't fit neatly into our modern categories. But we are told that St. Paul was annoyed by what the spirit was doing, and he exorcised it. And it wasn't, you know, with the consent of the girl. He just said, come out of her. And it did. And we see similar cases where Jesus orders spirits out of people and there's no seeming consent by the person who's being exorcised. So it is possible to exorcise people without consent, but these days it's generally done with consent.
Tim, thank you for being quick and clear with your question there so we could get it in before the end. But you can hear the music, and that means we are coming to an end. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for another very fine hour.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett.
And weird questions drop today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Go to Mysterious FM. and check it out. That does it for us. We will be right back here doing this again on Monday. Not a pre-record, nothing. We'll just be back here doing our job, and we'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.